This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Thursday, April 4th. Ford Motor Company delays the start of electric vehicle production at an Ontario plant. What does this say about the future of Canada's EV industry? Plus, the United States draws a line in the sand, telling Israel it needs to come up with a plan to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Has that relationship fractured? And the Prime Minister juggles premiers pushing back against his government's housing and climate plans. The Power Panel on the state of federal-provincial relations. U.S. automaker Ford is delaying the start of electric vehicle production at its plant in Oakville, Ontario, by 2 years. The plant was slated to begin production in 2025 and is now pushing that back to 2027. Some employees will remain on site during this time, but according to a company spokesperson, there will be layoffs. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said today that Canada will continue the transition to electric vehicles.
Obviously, different companies will make decisions that make sense for them, but what we're seeing is an incredible adoption rate of electric vehicles and the manufacturing and the entire manufacturing chain that we're building up in Canada. We've continued to draw in investments from around the world and we'll continue to be there to invest in a strong future as those projects and those jobs are created.
Brian Kingston is the president of the Canadian Vehicle Manufacturers Association, and he joins me now. Brian Kingston, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
So Ford delaying the start of electric vehicle production by 2 years. There's thousands of jobs affected by this and supply chain implications. What does this move say about the state of the EV transition in this country?
Well, the transformation is challenging. What we're seeing right now is automakers effectively creating a new supply chain from zero production level up to replacing all existing gas-powered vehicles on the road is the objective. And, you know, the government's goal is 100% EV sales by 2035. This takes time. It won't be linear in terms of the pathway to that 100%, but we have to take a step back and look at the progress we've made. In 3 years, we've gone from zero to over $30 billion of investment into automotive in this country, the majority dedicated to EV assembly. So we're on track, but there's going to be ups and downs in this transition.
Okay, but this delay, this in particular delay, do you think this is Ford specific, or could this be broader sectoral, a start of something that we may see at other producers here in the country?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a couple of things happening more broadly in the automotive industry. First is supply chain hiccups. Automakers are going through a once-in-a-century transformation. Now they have to go from mining critical minerals to assembling electric vehicle batteries. This is a whole new technology. It takes time. There will be challenges. Secondly, the consumer needs to come along for the ride. And we are seeing challenges with respect to consumer demand for electric vehicles. It is increasing, absolutely. But when you speak to Canadians, when you speak to North Americans, they are concerned about charging infrastructure and they are concerned about affordability. We are in a high interest rate environment. Purchasing a new vehicle that is more expensive than a traditional gas-powered vehicle is a challenge. So if we don't address those issues, you will see delays, and some of the targets that governments have set will become unachievable very quickly.
Right. Okay. I want to talk about that in a second. But just on this, I mean, this EV transformation, so important to the industrial policy of southern and southwestern Ontario. This is, you know, big bets made by companies and governments. A delay like this makes you wonder, okay, is this working as intended? I guess, should people be worried given the exposure taxpayers have committed to this and the importance of these sectors in the economy?
Absolutely not. Long term, this is the direction that industry is going. Electrification has proven to be extremely effective. And frankly, look, 15 years ago, the House of Commons put out a report entitled The Crisis in Canada's Automotive Sector. As people were calling about the demise of Canada's automotive industry, look at where we are today with all of this reinvestment. Yes, there will be challenges with electrification, but we are in a far better place as a country and as an industry than we were just 3 short years ago.
Okay, I want to get back to those targets. There is about a 30% sales target for 2030, if I'm remembering this correctly, but it is 100% by 2035. So they're not talking about linear growth in that 5-year period. They want it to really jump. I think we're close to 20%, give or take, right now. I mean, can Canada hit the target with this kind of a delay by Ford, which would suggest supply challenges, and with the charging and other challenges you've outlined?
Yeah, the targets that the federal government has set through their EV sales mandate right now are unachievable. They want to get to 20% sales in 2026. We've just crossed the 10% sales threshold, 60% in 2030, and then 100% by 2035. But the government has not adequately addressed the barriers to EV adoption. We see it in survey after survey of Canadians and consumers. The price gap is real. Yes, it will go away as the technology develops, but we need strong purchase incentives to help Canadians switch. And charging infrastructure. If you can't charge your vehicle at home and depend on public charging infrastructure, we're going to need far more available to Canadians. According to our analysis, we need to see 100 public chargers being built every single day for the next 11 years. I see no plan to make that happen.
Does that have to be done by government? Can that be done by the private sector? Can that be done by industry, municipally, provincially? You know, is this all on the federal government to do?
No. There are roles for all players, including the private sector. But right now, if you look at the on-road Canadian vehicle fleet, we're talking about 3.5% of vehicles that are electric. So there is very little private sector incentive to invest in this because you're not going to have that many vehicles coming to your charging station. So in these early days of adoption, government does have a huge role to play. Not just the federal government, provinces too, and we've seen provinces unroll ambitious charging plans. But over time, yes, private sector money will flow into this as people will see viable business models. On the incentive side, that's where government has to play a strong role right now. The price gap will come down as manufacturers invest in this technology, but it's not happening overnight, as we've seen with some of the recent announcements.
There's a $5,000 federal subsidy for buying an electric vehicle that qualifies. There are provincial subsidies in British Columbia and Quebec that are been proven to be quite effective in inducing demand. There isn't one here in Ontario. There was one, but the current government got rid of it. What do you want to see from the federal government in the budget on this? And what would you like to see provincial governments do if this transformation is going to take hold?
We'd like to see a couple things. First of all, the federal government needs to commit to extend its purchase incentive. It will run out of money very, very soon. And it will run out of money, frankly, before the EV sales mandate comes into force in 2026. That's not going to work. And then at the provincial level, we've seen provinces like Quebec recently announce that they're actually going to roll back their incentive. That's not helpful to this transition. So we need provinces to commit to this. Every single province should have a plan to help consumers make the switch to electric, make these vehicles more affordable. Not forever, but in these early years, particularly when you have a federal sales mandate in place, you have to help Canadians switch. You can't mandate them to buy these vehicles.
This is these challenges for this sector and this market is happening at the same time that people are pushing back at things like carbon pricing, because climate as a priority has shifted down below just base affordability. We're seeing all of these announcements from federal ministers focusing on affordability, focusing on housing, and this is the direction where the public mood seems to be. How hopeful are you that you're going to see something to help with these challenges in a federal budget that seems to be primarily about one thing, and it's a big one?
Yeah, I'm not hopeful that this is going to focus in the budget, but it frankly needs to. We have to have an honest conversation for the exact reasons that you've just laid out. This transition won't work if it is forced upon people. We need to win Canadians over with superior technology and a product that meets all of their needs and frankly is better than a gas-powered vehicle. But if we don't have the infrastructure in place, if it's more expensive, that is a very hard argument to make. And I worry with the government's approach on this by putting in place a mandate, it could actually create a blowback to the technology, which is absolutely not what we need, given the investments that manufacturers have made in this.
I mean, sales are going up. The rate hasn't continued at sort of the explosion rates as the early adopters got in. But I wonder, Brian, what kind of a message do you think this move by Ford sends to consumers out there, right, that are thinking about making this like a $60,000 or $70,000 purchase, and Ford is saying we need to slow down because of we're not sure how this is going to go? I mean, do you worry about a dampening message coming out of that?
No, I don't worry about that, simply because if you look at the models that have been made available to Canadians over the past few years, I mean, phenomenal growth. We've gone in 2012, there were 2-3 EV models in the Canadian market. There are over 80 this year, and manufacturers, including Ford, are providing a full range of electrified options to consumers. So this is happening. The models are there. And if you want an electrified pickup truck or a small car, it's available. So, you know, I think Canadians should be reassured that they can buy an EV and they'll find one that meets their needs. But if they don't have the corresponding supports on the infrastructure and incentive side, that will be a problem.
Okay. Brian Kingston, President of the Canadian Vehicle Manufacturers Association, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Ford Motor Company is delaying the start of electric vehicle production at its Oakville, Ontario plant by 2 years. A spokesperson for the U.S. automaker says there will be layoffs. Industry Minister François-Philippe Champagne said today he'll be working with the company to minimize that impact.
That is not what we expected. It's not what we wanted. So we'll be working with the workers. We'll be working with Unifor and with Ford to put pressure to say, how can we squeeze that? Because, you know, what makes Ford Oakville so special is the people. It's the expertise, the talent, the experience they have. And that's going to be what I'm going to say to Ford. We need to maintain these people to make sure that for the next generation of vehicle, the talent you have remains to build a new one.
Lana Payne is the national president of Unifor, and she joins us now. Lana, it's good to speak with you again. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, David. Appreciate it.
A tough day for Unifor, a tough day for your members. What does this two-year delay on production at the Oakville plant, what does that mean for the thousands of people you represent there?
Oh, it's really, really tough news and a brutal day for them. You know, we had a plan in place, or at least a plan that we thought was solid, for this plant. It had got reconfirmed in bargaining last fall. You know, we were looking at producing EVs by 2025, and now we're looking at a massive delay here of 2 years. So 3 years from now, and that means a lot of downtime for thousands of workers. So our priority will be, David, to meet immediately with the company to make sure that our members, all these workers, are taken care of during that, what is now a massively extended retooling and transition period, but also to explore any single possibility to try and lessen and mitigate the impact on, you know, 3,200 of our members right now.
Okay, so it's 3,200 of your members who work directly for the plant. I mean, what would be the status for them now? Do they get layoffs until the plant goes back into operations after the refurbishing? I mean, what is their employment status? What is their income status as you know it at this point?
Yeah, so these will be a number of things that we'll have to work out with the company, but they would have been laid off anyway because of the initial timeline. Some would have continued to work to help with the retooling, whether they were in skilled trades or whatever their classification in the plant. So not everybody would have been experiencing a layoff. And in that layoff, we also negotiated what we called EV income security supports in when we bargained with Ford Motor Company last fall. And that would have guaranteed our members support of up to 70% of their pay during the retooling and transition period. So now, obviously, we have to go back to the company and say, this is a decision you made. You have a responsibility to our members. We want to see this support that we negotiated for the original time period to be expanded so that our members are not going unprotected and without income during this period.
Okay, so that income protection, I presume, Lana, would have run until sometime in 2025 when the plant was supposed to reopen, because your collective agreement, as I understand it, only runs until 2026, and now the new timeline for reopening is 2027. So there's a lot of milestones in that period, which means a lot of work to be done here.
Yes, there is going to be a lot of work over the coming days and weeks to make sure that we're getting clarity and certainty and security for our members, but also pressing the company to look at other options here, David. We know markets change quickly. So being, you know, be able to be flexible to accommodate and do different things, to leave no stone unturned in terms of how we can lessen the impact on Canadian auto workers right now. They were part of buying into this big project of being part of the EV transition. They still believe in it. We still believe in it. We know that there have been some shifts in the markets in the last 6 months or so, but Canada needs to be on track to continue to get a piece of this massive investment that's going on in the world right now.
You say they still believe in it. You still believe in it. Do you think they still believe in it in Oakville, given what we've seen today? Do you accept that this is just a delay because of market conditions, or are you worried it could be a shift in larger corporate focus and corporate priorities for Ford?
Well, I mean, the reality is Ford is a big player in the EV markets already. I think they're number two in North America. They are committed to this, and we know that the markets are growing. They might not be growing as much as they were in the last 6 months or so, but there is still a massive shift happening in terms of consumers shifting to EVs. We're at, I think in the United States, about 1 in 5 vehicles right now are electric or hybrid, compared to just 4% in 2019. So, you know, the world is moving in this direction. There are government mandates around net zero. The industry has to do a transformation here, and Canada needs to be part of the transformation. And we're going to continue to push to make sure that Ford Motor Company lives up to its commitment to our members.
There are some operations that are still moving ahead with for 2026, I believe, in Tennessee. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. I mean, do you worry about a shift to the U.S. As a focus of operations right now? Or I guess what's your confidence level that this is still a core part of Ford's plan going forward?
I don't think Ford Motor Company has a choice but to have Canada as part of its future. It has been making cars in this country for generations, and it would be a mistake to stop making them. We expect cars to be sold in Canada, to be made in Canada. This is something that we fight for as an auto workers union, and something we're going to continue to fight for.
Is this a market challenge only, Lana, or is there a policy component to this too? I wonder, are there things in place or not in place at the provincial and federal level that could either help here or are part of the challenge you're facing in Oakville?
Yeah, all kinds of things are occurring right now, David. It's markets, it's changing policy in the United States, which, as you know, the Biden administration has stretched out some of the emission targets that they had in place from 2030 to 2032. This has caused the companies to reconsider their timelines. Obviously, we want governments to think about incentives, because we're at that next level of consumers now who need to adopt to EVs. And the early adopters we've gone through, I'm sure the industry analysts would agree. And now we're at the next generation. But there's also some technology challenges. There's battery challenges. This is a massive transformation, and there are a lot of factors playing into this right now.
So what has to happen next year, Lana? I know you've got 3,000 workers who are very worried, and their families, and then there's the supply chains that feed into this plant, and we're expecting to feed into this plant starting next year when this original conversion was supposed to be in place. What are you watching for next on this whole thing?
Obviously, we have a number of facilities in Canada that will be going through a transition. Our job is to make sure that we're nailing down these companies as best as we can to be sticking with timelines. And if there are changes in those timelines, they have to come in and support workers through this to make sure that they have the skills that they need when they're ready to build these electric vehicles. And it's not going to be easy. No transition is easy. But as long as we're here protecting our members and fighting for them, that's what we're going to do. Continue to fight for auto workers and a robust auto sector in this country.
We heard, just as a final point, from Industry Minister Champagne today, who said clearly this is not the news they wanted to hear. This is not the timeline for the transition they wanted to see, and that they are going to press the company to make this delay as short as possible. Have you been in contact with the federal government on any of this? What would you like to hear from them at this point?
I think that is an excellent starting point. I'm sure the provincial government here in Ontario will be saying the same, that they expect Ford Motor Company to live up to its commitments to Canadian workers right now. We are saying the same thing. And obviously, everything that part of the discussions that we'll be having with the company is not just around income support, but what else can happen here and how can we look at shortening these timelines. All of those things have to be part of these conversations.
Lana Payne, National President of Unifor, we appreciate the time.
Thank you, David.
Look, and speaking of the Prime Minister, he got a friendly reception at his latest funding announcement for affordable housing that was in Winnipeg today. But the Prime Minister and Manitoba Premier Wab Kanu, they have their positions on climate plans that include carbon pricing. Those were not so in alignment.
Provinces are free to move forward on their own pricing systems as long as they hit the same levels and the same outcomes that are in place across the country.
So I look forward to bringing our plan, which is a credible plan for net zero to be achieved here in Manitoba, through the new steps we're taking to electrify and decarbonize the way that you get to work and the way that you heat your home. we've got a very strong case to make.
Okay, that's the next topic I want to talk about with the power panel here, because, Andrew, there's a lot of things going on in the federal-provincial dynamic over the past week and a half. We're getting the budget day by day rather than page by page on budget day. A lot of it is either things that the provinces are upset because it goes into their jurisdiction, or it's things that require them to change some things to get the money. And then there is the ongoing conversation about climate, and Manitoba's Wab Kanoo says he wants to be exempt from the carbon price, but he doesn't have a plan that we know of yet that includes a replacement for the carbon price. What's your thoughts on this dynamic as we see climate and budget all rolling out over the past week?
Well, let me just start by saying I think it's a super smart strategy the Liberals are embarking on to get these announcements out in digestible portions so that people are able to hear, you know, positive announcements, announcements that tie back to the core narrative of this government, and have that kind of over a period of, you know, they're essentially driving a lot of the news cycle over a two-week period before the budget. That's a pretty smart communication strategy and shows that, you know, both they've got a little bit of a gumption back to take the fight to the Conservatives and that they've got a strategy to do it. On the question of pricing, and I think this is where, you know, the Prime Minister runs into problems, he has set all of his objective around establishing this downstream consumer-based carbon tax, this carbon price at the consumer level. Yes, he's offsetting it by this new welfare system that he's set up of rebates that are completely, or at least not transparently connected to what any one of us is paying on the tax. What you're seeing Wab Kanoo and others start to do is go back to almost, I mean, to be quite blunt, the same kind of thing that the Liberals had in Ontario before the Ford government, setting up these emission systems so that we've got this upstream carbon tax in place, where you can recoup the costs and then spend it on things that will actually put new charging systems in place, that will put in place the technologies that will allow the economy to transition. Now, Manitoba's in a pretty unique place because of the way its electricity is generated. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, we could see that in a number of other provinces. And, in fact, Ontario had a very successful scheme in place just before the last before the Ford government was elected.
Yeah, so they had a cap-and-trade system, James, which put a price on a ton of carbon, same way Quebec's system does, and Ford got rid of it, and that's why they've ended up with the backstop. And now we're seeing Kanoo saying they don't want a price, cap-and-trade, or direct pricing whatsoever. They want credit for the other things they're doing. Tim Houston has said much the same thing out of Nova Scotia, but it all fails to meet what is required under the law right now to have a price there. So is this a path forward, or is this just another flashpoint for them to butt heads with the Prime Minister?
Probably a path forward. And, you know, while Andrew's giving out kudos, I think one is should be offered as well to Premier Kanoo as well for showing some, I think, diplomatic sophistication on behalf of the people of Manitoba to build clearly a healthy relationship both with Pierre Poilievre and with the current Prime Minister Trudeau as two different mm-hmm. paths forward to try to get some progress for his province. You know, the reality about, I think, about federal-provincial relations is that it's never all hot and it's never all cold. And even with an individual premier on a one-on-one basis, it's never all hot and it's never all cold. The question is, can the prime minister and the premier of a given province prioritize their issues in a way that align so they can work together? Gordon Campbell, when he was premier of British Columbia, was very effective at this. He worked with prime ministers Crichamp and then Martin and then Harper. And then his top two or three issues that he wanted to focus on in a calendar year were always aligned with the interests of the prime minister. And just it's about getting things done. Wab Kanoo seems to be doing that here. Climate change is one of those top three issues with this province. And the problem for the prime minister, where he's going to have to take a bit of a backseat, I think, on this subject matter, is that, look, he's lost the fight, I think, broadly on the issue of the carbon tax to Pierre Poilievre. And the premiers, there's not one province, except maybe the province of Quebec, where the net negatives for Justin Trudeau are significantly worse than the incumbent premier. And so the premiers are in a power position, knowing that almost all of them are going to go to the polls after the next federal election campaign. So they're not being held by any standard by Justin Trudeau in terms of public opinion or expectation relative to what's going to be debated in the next election campaign. So I think Premier Kanoo here finding some space for himself and for the province, I think, will probably be a model not only on climate change but for a number of other issues that other provinces will start to find their voice on. And I think that's good for Confederation. Provinces are meant to have different standards, expectations, and priorities and ways of dealing with the federal government. We're a confederation. It works that way.
Yeah, Shachi, I mean, Bob Kanu is very new in his premiership, so we'll see where that goes. But James makes a point there on the relationship with the Prime Minister. David Eby in British Columbia, a lot of his housing policies seem to be the model for this federal budget rollout that Andrew thinks has been effective. But what's interesting in some of these policies is that it essentially says the premiers wanted them to stop cutting deals with municipalities and to cut it with the provinces. They say, okay, here are the table stakes. And if you don't meet my conditions, I'm going to go to your mayors and I'm going to go to your councils. How will that play, do you think? There's been some pushback on jurisdiction, but the Prime Minister gets blamed for things that aren't his jurisdiction, so you may as well just do it when your job is on the line, I guess.
So the risk there is being painted into a corner around what constitutes good enough, and whether right. that's on housing or whether that is on carbon pricing or a provincial carbon plan. So Premier Kanu has come out and said, hey, we're going to try and do this. We're going to bring something to the Prime Minister. Look at us. We're being proactive. It's not going to serve Justin Trudeau or his government one moment if he then is in a situation where he goes, but this isn't good enough. It's not quite net zero. And that's the challenge. So, you know, on one hand, he is demonstrating that, hey, there are premiers that I can work with. There are premiers who want to work with me, which is helpful in trying to sort of fend off the criticism. And, you know, he was on The Current this morning talking about the fact that, well, I met with the premiers in 2016. And I was like, but it's 2024. So, I mean, there is a challenge around that. However, he can say, look, there are certain premiers that I can work with, that I'm prepared to work with. That's for the benefit of everyone. But what he cannot risk is a situation where then the answer back to the province is, but your plan isn't good enough, it's not stringent enough, because again, that is where you risk losing people to crossing their arms, plugging their ears and saying, you know what, we're done listening, and we've already made up our mind and our opinion on this is now baked in. And we've talked over weeks about this, that I do believe he's perilously close to losing the room on the issues of carbon pricing.
But Carly, what about on the other issues they're rolling out on housing, on apartment construction? These are things that, like, Ford has said, I'm not going to do this. Premier Ford, not the Ford Motor Company. He says, I'm not going to do this because I don't want to tell municipalities what to do. And they're saying, fine, we'll just go around you to the municipalities. Is that a thing Canadians will get worked up about, or is this the sort of thing that only premiers care about?
I think it is great to see the federal government showing a little bit of backbone on this. I think they have recognized that the level of public frustration around housing and its affordability, lack of affordability, has reached the point where people say, I don't really care who does it, just fix it, do something. I think Sean Fraser in particular has been a real standout kind of star on this. I think he's been one of the most effective cabinet ministers that I've seen in the last number of years, in the way that he is completely unafraid to go to the provinces and say, as you said earlier, here are the table stakes, take it or leave it. Either you move, or in some cases, as he did with Ontario Minister Calandra last Friday, I pull back the money, or this is, you know, traditionally your jurisdiction, but I'm going to move in and do it because I can and because I think it's important. You really are seeing the Prime Minister in particular, too, back on his front foot the last few days with this sort of pre-budget rollout. I think it is pretty fascinating how they have broken the traditional model of how budgets are unveiled. And I know this has been talked about a lot, but it's hard to imagine that any future government will actually go back to the old way of doing things after this, of waiting till budget day and at 4 p.m. laying it all out there, because it's really hard to keep the public attention and the media attention on it after 2 or 3 days. Instead, they've been driving the news cycle for the last just about 2 weeks now on the topics that they want to be talking about, like these pretty solid housing policies that are coming out with, including today the piece about trying to put a dent in the number of rent evictions that are happening. So I think they've been pretty smart on that. I also think when it comes to the carbon pricing system, the Prime Minister was very clever in the way he handled the press conference with Premier Kanu today, because you heard him come back to base principles 3 times in that press conference, where he said, At the end of the day, what I care about is that it is not free to pollute anywhere in this country. As long as the emissions targets are being hit, there are many ways to go about that. I think he's laying track because he's expecting that Premier Kinnear's plan is not going to look exactly like the federal plan.
Okay, well, we've got to see, and we're trying to get Premier Kinnear to come on and tell us about that. But, Andrew, I wonder, as someone who was a provincial finance minister, when the federal government is going around saying, we have all this money, but we need you to do these things, or you can't have it, and we'll give it to, you know, the mayors of Regina or Saskatoon, in your case. I mean, how does that fly in terms of relationship management and in terms of, you know, politics at the provincial level?
Yeah, you know, it's not great for the relationship, but it's politics. I mean, and, you know, provinces try to extract as much value as they can on the terms they want. In some ways, it's a no-lose for them. The province can stand its ground. The money's going to still flow into the province. It just doesn't flow through their treasury. So I don't think that there's necessarily a lot of people who would be boo-hoo-hooing about this. It's not like Toronto and Ottawa and other cities in Ontario aren't going to get the money. And so, you know, the question is, does this allow, in some ways, a win for those governments that want to hold out, like Ford or Moe or others, to simply, you know, stand their ground on their conservative principles and realize that the money's still going to flow in anyway. It's not optimal. I mean, everyone would rather have, you know, the happy photo ops and to be able to show that they're kind of joined up and that governments work. But on the other hand, from a political standpoint, there's not a lot to be lost on this.
James, it's clearly an attempt to try to, you know, take control of a narrative, have their perceived to be better communicators out delivering the budget news, because they've had some challenges with the finance ministers in this government in terms of being able to get a lift for their financial plan. I mean, and it also puts the prime minister sort of in that campaign type of environment where he seems to do better in their assessment. What do you think of the effectiveness of the tactic that we're seeing here?
Well, we'll see in the fullness of time. I do agree with what was said, that he seems to be on his front foot. He's talking about the issues that he cares about, and he's off holiday. And I don't mean that as a poke. I mean, like, off the sort of the messaging holiday track, where it was just kind of a constancy of sort of reaction with a very sort of passive voice. You know, they need to be on the offense. You know, this is a lame Canadian thing, but politics really is like hockey, in the sense that you either have the puck and you're driving on offense and you're trying to score a goal, or you're on defense getting backwards and trying to react to the other guys. And so you want the puck and you want to be driving with it. And Pierre Poilievre has been for over a year, and it shows in the polls. He chose the right issues. He communicated it well to the audiences he was trying to reach to. Prime Minister Trudeau and this government, they'll have their opportunity in this budget. The question is the next election ballot question time for change? Anything that's going to shift from that, we'll see in the fullness of time.
Shashi, what's your
effort to do it?
Oh, sorry. Sorry, James, you froze up there for a second. I thought you were done. Finish your thought.
No. Yeah, feel free. I was going to say, we'll see if it works in the fullness of time. But I think for Liberals, they must be happy to see him fighting again. We'll see if there's going to be any receipt for the public in the end.
Yeah, no, Shashi, proof of life is certainly something Liberals have been keen to see from the government for a while. I just wonder what your sense of looking at it, just sort of assessing it. James is right. I mean, Pierre Poilievre has driven the political narrative in this town and nationally on a lot of key issues for quite some time. And this seems to be an attempt to try to take the puck back, as James would say, and at least control time of possession for a little bit. And it's working to some degree, I think, at least in terms of setting a news agenda and having some fresh things to talk about to Canadians. What's your sense of how effective it is?
It's absolutely working. From how much oxygen are we exhaling about what the Prime Minister did or said today, and how much ink is being spilled, there is obviously some pugilism there. The sleeves are rolled up, and he wants to take the fight back. And we've seen this, and so we've seen it subsequently over time. How many times over the years and over subsequent election cycles have people wanted to come in and call in the holy person and pronounce last rites on the Prime Minister's political career? It has not happened as yet, and he clearly, I think, is showing signs that he's not done. He said so. Mm-hmm. It's been questioned over time, but he's demonstrating that he doesn't think he's done. In terms of what James says around the fullness of time, you know, you can get the housing stuff done. You can do all of those things. And people, voters, at the end of the day, if indeed they feel that the Liberals have had their time, had their moment, and this is a change election, will say, thank you very much for all of that. We're not going to vote for you anyway. And so what we need to now look at is the extent to which the Prime Minister and this government gets any lift, if if at all, from sort of this late surge in energy that we're seeing at this stage. And I would say it's still an open question, but I still think he's got quite a tough uphill battle to fight.
Yeah, and Carlene, I mean, you know, the Liberals in this town I speak with, they are worried about that, that you just reach a point in a government life cycle that people aren't listening to you, but also what they're doing these last couple of weeks. It's tough to sustain that when you've got a government to run and things happen that knock you off the sort of the budget announcement. And can you match the sort of permanent campaign that we're seeing from Pierre Poilievre as leader of the opposition?
There's a long time to go before the next election. It's most likely at least a year, could be even a little bit longer if we're going into fall 2025. Is the prime minister's newfound spring in his step sustainable? Perhaps, perhaps not. Is Pierre Poilievre's dominance in the pool sustainable for that long? That's a question that I think is also unanswered at this point, because it's pretty hard to hold a 15-point lead for that long without taking a few knocks or accumulating a little bit of baggage. There's a long way to go. The last thing I would say is that we cannot forget how much campaigns matter. I've watched two change elections happen, 05, 06, and the 2015 election, both of which had the shared similarity of being excruciatingly long. One of them stretched over Christmas, I'm sure you remember. And the 2015 campaign, I think, was 72 days. Both of those campaigns ended in a change in government. And that was not the general consensus at the time, necessarily. Perhaps a little bit more so in 05, but certainly not in 2015. So not only do we have a long way to go before the election, but I think certainly Justin Trudeau has proven more than once that he's not to be underestimated in a campaign scenario. And I think Poilievre is also probably going to be a strong campaigner. So we got to wait till the writ drops.
Well, okay. I argue 2015 was a change election regardless. It was just a question of change to whom.
Right. So. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you ran in that one.
I don't know if people really thought Thomas Mulcair was going to be president.
I think it started in 2014. It ran forever, that election.
Yeah. Well, look, we're out of time. I got to go. But Carlene, clearly the trick for the Liberals is just on April 17th, start announcing the 2025 budget day by day. All right. I want to thank the Power Panel for being here with me. Carlene Varian, Andrew Thompson, James Moore, and Shachi Curl.
Thanks, David.
Thanks.
U.S. President Joe Biden has warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. policy around Gaza could change if Israel doesn't take new steps in its war against Hamas. The U.S. Secretary of State laid out what Biden told Netanyahu.
He made clear the need for Israel to announce a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers. He made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps.
For what this change by the U.S. could mean for the war in Gaza, Rhonda Sleem is the senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, and she joins me now. Rhonda, it's good to speak with you again.
Good to be with you, David.
We have heard language from the United States before about the need to take steps to protect civilians and aid workers. I've never heard them say our approach to the war in Gaza depends on these immediate changes. What do you make of this move by the United States?
Well, we are transition. I mean, the United States government, particularly the president, is finally transitioning from the state of unconditional support for Israel to a state of potentially conditional support of Israel. With maybe sanctions on the table, maybe with conditions put on arms support, military support from the United States to Israel. But as I said, it's a transition. We'll see, you know, whether he's going to move forward. But given the language that was issued on based on the readout of the call between the two leaders by the White House, I don't think that unless Netanyahu comes up with a drastic change in the way that Israel has been conducting, you know, this war, this assault, I don't think that Biden is not going to have to impose some conditions on Israel going forward. It's going to be very hard. He has to. The rhetoric has changed. I mean, it's still rhetoric, but the quality of the rhetoric, the quality of the change is marked than before, much more marked, different than before, and it has now to be followed by actions if there is no drastic change by Israel.
So I watched the briefing today with John Kirby, who is a spokesperson on national security issues for the government, takes a lot of the questions on this particular conflict. He kept saying, what's the or else? And he wouldn't give specifics on this, but he kept saying, we need to see what Israel does in the hours and days ahead. So this is not something with a long horizon on it for them to see something from Israel before they respond. How do you think Benjamin Netanyahu will respond? How Israel will respond? Because to this point, they don't seem to have made the kind of changes the president and other Western allies have insisted upon.
I think, I mean, Netanyahu faces a crisis. I mean, either he's going to lose his only international ally left right now, meaning the United States, or he's going to use allies in his governing council. Because the kind of drastic change that is going to get the president attention and is going to, you know, help reduce some of the anger that exists in this country, including among the strongest support base of the president himself, I think is going to create trouble for Netanyahu with his own right-wing allies in his government. And so he is facing, you know, what's going to be, which is going to be the less costly of these options, you know, losing the United States and the support of the president, or losing his allies in the governing council.
It's interesting because in the war cabinet and in the coalition that he's built, right?
Sorry. Yeah, I'm thinking of a different country here.
Yeah, okay. I gotcha. But it's interesting though the domestic political considerations that Netanyahu has to weigh. Biden is also weighing domestic political considerations. We saw protest votes in Michigan and in Wisconsin and some key states with large Arab American populations that potentially threaten, if they're so demotivated, it threatens his presidential rematch with Donald Trump in the fall of this year. So it seems like the domestic pressure on both sides is an important thing that filters up to the international relationships, the bilateral relationships between the two. I mean, where do you see that relationship potentially going? Because even sort of laying this condition out there from the White House suggests that things are going to be very different tomorrow than they are today.
I mean, I don't see this relationship fracturing. It's historical, is deeply anchored in the history of the two countries, in the social fabrics of the two countries. I mean, also we have to take into consideration that Netanyahu is facing his own domestic pressure about the return of the hostage, the negotiation. And also a good part of the call based on the readout is this urgency or this pressure or call by the president on Netanyahu to empower his own negotiators to reach a deal over ceasefire and the hostage release. And that is this particular part of the readout is addressed to the thousands of Israelis who have been demonstrating outside the prime minister's residences and offices calling for the return of the hostages. So, I mean, Netanyahu can put up pressure on Biden domestically, but also Biden is trying to increase the pressure on Netanyahu domestically. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this is going to play out. Now, we have to also factor in, what is Iran going to do? You know, there is a potential response from Iran in retaliation for the Israeli attack on its consulate in Damascus and the killing of senior IRGC generals. And so the question is, will Tehran, you know, order some kind of a ballistic missile attack on Tel Aviv, or will it order its proxies in the different fronts that are now being fought, with Israel, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, the Iraqi militias via Syria, will it order them to attack, you know, Israel via drone missiles? So it's going to be interesting. The situation right now is very complicated in the region, domestically in the two countries, and internationally.
You said you don't think the Israel-U.S. relationship will fracture. I think you're right on that because of the historic connection there. But could the Biden-Netanyahu relationship fracture? I mean, we saw that speech that Chuck Schumer gave in the Senate, you know, a Jewish Senate leader for the Democrats saying Bibi Netanyahu's got to go. He's lost his way. I mean, do you think this could be the beginning of a shift of that kind of magnitude and a fracture between the two leaders, if not the two countries?
I think so. I think definitely the unconditional support that Biden thought he needed to provide to Netanyahu and to Israel to influence him as a policy, as a strategy, I think now he's convinced it has failed. And so he's definitely shifting toward a new strategy, conditional supports, threat of sanctions. And whether it's going to fracture relationship, I don't know. But whether there was a very good relationship between them, also right. something to be debated. But definitely is going to put this relationship, person relationship, which Biden has really worked hard to maintain, under threat.
So just as a final point, I know you talked about the potential for escalation because of the various militias and proxies aligned with Iran. We've seen this in the United States. There's also pushback coming from the United Kingdom, and a lot of countries lost civilians in this aid strike that Israel says was an accident. What do you think all of this means, this U.S. shift in particular today, for the broader international view of the way Israel is doing this war against Hamas?
I mean, I'm really sorry for every death that has happened, but also it is, for me, to be very honest, as an American, it's sad that it took the death of six Westerners to provoke this kind of reaction from the United States president, and not the death of 32,000 innocent Palestinians. You know, I mean, for me, I mean, I'm happy that there is a shift in U.S. policy, but I would have liked to see it before. Mm. And maybe if that shift has happened before, maybe would have avoided a lot of death, not only among the Palestinian, but also the unfortunate accident. I mean, the unfortunate death. It's not an accident. I mean, the head of World Kitchen Central is saying it's not an accident. It's right. It's a targeting of these cars. It's a specific car targeting of these cars in an area that is controlled by the Israelis, by the Israeli Defense Forces. And so, in a way, I'm happy that the shift is happening, but I wish that shift has started to happen not 6 months after the start of the war, but 6 months before, you know, as soon as possible. And maybe we could have avoided a lot of death.
Rhonda Sleem, always appreciate the time. Rhonda Sleem is a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau also condemned that Israeli strike that killed seven aid workers in Gaza, including one Canadian. And Trudeau reiterated Canada's call for an open and independent investigation into exactly what happened.
I have to directly take issue with what Prime Minister Netanyahu said yesterday when he said, well, this just happens in conflicts and in wartime. No, it doesn't just happen. And it shouldn't just happen. When you have aid workers for an extraordinary organization like World Central Kitchen risking their lives every day in an incredibly dangerous place to deliver food to people who are experiencing a horrific humanitarian catastrophe, that is not okay.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.